Shapur the Great, who had driven the invading Arabs out of his southern realm at the beginning of his reign, had continued an enthusiastic campaign into the Arabian interior. For his entire reign, Al-Tabari tells us, Shapur was occupied with great eagerness in killing the Arabs and tearing out the shoulder blades of their leaders. This was why they called him Dhu al-Aqtaf, the man of the shoulders. Author's note, the tearing of the shoulders, a custom that seems to have been peculiar to Shapur II, did not necessarily kill the victim. Instead, it left the sword arm, used to fight against the Persian king, useless and dangling. Ezana's conversion assured him of Constantine's support, should Persian aggression move across the water. For the moment, Shapur left the African kingdom alone. Instead, his soldiers invaded Armenia. Armenia, which had been a kingdom for nearly a millennium, had long suffered from its position on the eastern frontier of Rome. For centuries, Roman emperors had either allied themselves with the Armenian kings or invaded the kingdom in an effort to make it part of the empire. The eastern kingdoms of the ancient Persians and Parthians had done the same, hoping to make Armenia a buffer against Roman expansion. At the moment, Armenia was independent, but once again squeezed between two large and expanding empires. It was not at war with either Rome or Persia, but it tended towards friendship with the Roman Empire. The king of Armenia, Tiridates, had been baptized by a monk named Gregory back in 303, before Christianity was politically useful. When Constantine made Christianity the religion of the empire, Armenia's ties with its western neighbor grew even stronger. Agents of Shapur the Great, who was increasingly worried that a Christian Armenia would never again serve as an ally of the Persian Empire, managed to convince Tiridates' chamberlain to turn traitor. In 330, the chamberlain poisoned his king. Unfortunately for the Persians, this did not turn Armenia away from Christianity. Instead, Tiridates became a martyr and eventually a saint, and his son, Khosrov the Short, became king. Since the indirect approach had failed, Shapur sent soldiers. The 336 invasion of Armenia failed. The soldiers withdrew, but Shapur had conveyed a clear message to Constantine. He didn't intend to relinquish the border areas to Rome, even if those border areas were Christian. Converting to Christianity had now gained all sorts of fraught political implications, and Shapur decided to crack down on Christianity in his own empire. In Persian eyes, Christians were increasingly likely to be double agents working for Rome. The systematic persecution of Persian Christians, mostly on the western frontier, began early in 337. The attacks were recorded by the Persian Christian Afrahat, who lived at the monastery of Mar Matai, on the eastern bank of the Tigris River. Shapur, he wrote to a fellow monk who lived outside Persia, caused a great massacre of martyrs, but the Persian Christians were holding strong. They believed that they would be blessed with a great reward, while the Persian persecutors would come to scorn and contempt. To the west, Constantine was plotting to make those words come true. He was preparing an invasion, but this invasion would be a crusade. His justification was that the Christians of Persia needed his help. He planned to take with him a portable tabernacle, a tent in which bishops, who would accompany the army, would lead regular worship, and he announced that he would be baptized, something he hadn't yet gotten around to, in the River Jordan, as soon as he reached it. It was the first time that a ruler had planned to wield the cross against an outside enemy. But before he could depart on his crusade, he grew sick, and on May 22, 337, Constantine the Great died. The name of his city was changed from Byzantium to Constantinople in his honour, and he was buried there in a mausoleum he had prepared at the Church of the Holy Apostles. The mausoleum had 12 symbolic coffins for the 12 apostles in it, with Constantine's as the 13th. Later historians called this an act of massive hubris, but the burial had its own logic. Constantine, like the apostles, was a founder of the faith. He alone of all the Roman emperors had honoured God the All-Sovereign. Eusebius concludes, he alone had honoured his church as no other since time began. His like has never been recorded from the beginning of time until our day. He had married Christianity and state politics, and in doing so had changed both forever. As soon as news of Constantine's death spread eastward, Shapur invaded Armenia again. This time he succeeded. Armenia's Christian king, Khosrov the Short, was forced to run for his life towards the Roman border. Shapur installed a Persian puppet in his place. The Buffer Kingdom was, at least temporarily, his. The Roman response was not immediate, because Constantine's heirs were busy trying to kill each other in Constantinople. Constantine, canny politician in life, had made no definite arrangements for the succession. It was almost as though he expected to live forever. Instead, he left behind three sons and a nephew, who had all been given the title of Caesar, who had all ruled for him in various parts of the empire, and who could all claim the right to the throne. No impartial historian records exactly what happened in the weeks after Constantine's death, but by the time the bloodshed ceased, Constantine's nephew, both of his brothers-in-law and a handful of high court officials, had been murdered. Constantine's three sons, Constantine II, 21, Constantius, 17, and Constans, 14, had come to some sort of family agreement that left the three of them alive and all possible competitors or naysayers dead. The only exception was their five-year-old cousin Julian, who was being raised in a castle in Asia Minor, well away from the purge. In September, the three sons had themselves acclaimed as co-emperors in Constantinople. The empire was again divided, this time into three parts, or prefectures. Constantine II took the prefecture of Gaul. Constans took the prefecture of Italy, which included not only Rome, but also North Africa. And Constantius took the entire prefecture of the East, along with the region of Thracia, which meant that he got Constantinople. Almost at once, Constantius reinvaded Armenia and put Khosrov the Short back on his throne. 14-year-old Constans, despite his age, soon showed that he was not to be trifled with. In 340, his brother Constantine II tried to take Italy from him. Constans went to war against his older brother, ambushed him in the north of Italy and killed him. Now the empire was again divided into two, between Constans in the west and Constantius in the east. Constans was a staunch supporter of the Christian church. Nevertheless, he was unpopular with everyone. His personality was so foul that even the church historians, normally fulsome about any Christian emperor, disliked him. He managed to survive for another 10 years, but in 350, at age 27, he was murdered by his own generals. Rather than throwing their support behind the remaining brother, Constantius, the generals then acclaimed a new co-emperor, an officer named Magnentius. Constantius marched west to get rid of the usurper, but it took 2 years of fighting before Magnentius was defeated. He killed himself rather than fall into Constantius's hands. By 352, Constantius, like his father, was ruler of the entire empire. Meanwhile, of course, Constantius had been away from his eastern border, and Shapur had taken advantage of his absence to take back Armenia yet again. The son of Khosrov the Short had been ruling as a Roman ally. Shapur invaded, captured the king, put out his eyes, and allowed his son to ascend the throne, only on the condition that he remain subject to Persian wishes. Constantius did not immediately answer this challenge. He had problems to solve, the most pressing of which was finding an heir. He had no son, so in 355 he appointed his surviving cousin Julian to be Caesar and heir. Julian, now 23, had been squirreled away in Asia Minor, being carefully trained in Christianity by the tutor Mardonius. Constantine preferred to reside in Constantinople, so he put Julian in charge of affairs on the western side of the empire. Here, the young man campaigned so successfully on the Rhine front that the army became his enthusiastic supporter. When he reduced taxation in the west, the people loved him too. While Julian's popularity grew, Constantius's waned. Like his father, Constantius was a Christian. Unlike his father, he was supportive of Arianism, now officially a heresy. In the same year that he appointed Julian as his Caesar, Constantius wielded his imperial authority to get rid of the Bishop of Rome, an anti-Arian churchman named Liberius, who disapproved of Constantius's beliefs. In Liberius's place, he appointed a bishop of his own choosing. This was a serious matter, as the Bishop of Rome was probably the most influential priest in the entire Christian church. The bishops of Rome considered themselves the spiritual heirs of the Apostle Peter, and they considered Peter to be the founder of the Christian church. For some decades already, the Bishop of Rome had claimed the right to make decisions that were binding on the bishops of other cities. Author's note: this belief was based on Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, where Jesus says to Peter, "Upon this rock I will build my church." The Roman Church interpreted this as saying that Peter was the founding apostle of the Christian Church. Since Peter then went to Rome to preach, the Roman Christians also considered Rome the birthplace of the Church. This privilege was far from unchallenged. The bishops of Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, all cities that could boast a Christian community as old as the Christian community in Rome, resented the assumption that Rome was the center of the Christian world. Nevertheless, all of the bishops could agree that Constantius ought not to appoint and remove any bishop at will. Constantius, paying no attention to their objections, called a church council of his own in 359, and announced at it that Arian Christology was now orthodox. Neither Roman bishop, either the deposed one or the newly appointed one, was invited. None of the churchmen were pleased with this high-handedness, which seems to have stemmed from real theological conviction. Certainly Constantius reaped no political benefits by meddling in church affairs in this way. Constantius grew increasingly unpopular, particularly with churchmen in the western half of the empire, where anti-Arian sentiment was strongest. So when Constantius, alarmed by Julian's swelling popularity, demanded that Julian in the west reduce his armed force by sending some of his troops eastward, Julian banked on his cousin's growing unpopularity in the west and his own stellar reputation, and refused. The army on the Rhine, backing him up, elevated him to the post of co-emperor. This put the empire back under two emperors, a situation that neither man found bearable. But Julian was not anxious to launch an out-and-out attack on Constantius, who, after all, had Constantinople and most of the east on his side. For his part, Constantius didn't dare leave the eastern borders and march west against Julian. The Persian threat was too immediate. Shapur's army was already approaching the Roman borders. The Roman soldier Ammianus Marcellinus, who later wrote a history of the Roman wars with Persia, had been sent secretly into Armenia, now Persian-controlled, to spy on the Persian advance. From the top of a cliff, he spotted the armies advancing. "The whole circuit of the lands filled with innumerable troops," he remembers, "with the king leading the way, glittering in splendid attire." The Roman army burned the fields and houses in front of the approaching enemy to prevent them from finding food, and made a stand at the Euphrates River. But the Persians, advised by a Roman traitor who had gone over to their side, made a detour north through untouched fields and orchards. The Romans pursued them, and the two armies finally met at the small walled city of Amida in Roman territory. The city was good for defense, since, as Ammianus Marcellinus explains, it could only be approached by a single narrow pass, and the Romans took up a defensive position in the gap. But a detachment of Persian cavalry had managed, without Romans' knowledge, to get around behind the city, and the Romans found themselves jammed into the pass, attacked from both sides. Ammianus, fighting in the middle of the throng, was trapped there for an entire day. "We remained motionless until sunrise," he writes. So crowded together that the bodies of the slain, held upright by the throng, could nowhere find room to fall, and that in front of me a soldier with his head cut in two and split into equal halves by a powerful sword stroke was so pressed on all sides that he stood erect like a stump. Finally, Ammianus and the other surviving Roman soldiers made it into the city. The Persians attacked the walls with archers and with war elephants, frightful with their wrinkled bodies and loaded with armed men, a hideous spectacle, dreadful beyond every form of horror. Amida withstood the siege for 73 days. The streets were stacked with maggot-infested bodies, and plague broke out within the walls. The defenders kept the wooden siege engines and the elephants at bay with burning arrows, but finally the Persians erected mounds of earth and came over the walls. The inhabitants were slaughtered. Ammianus escaped through a back gate and found a horse, trapped in a thicket and tied to its dead master. He untied the corpse and fled. Constantius was forced to surrender not only Amida, but also at least two other fortresses, a handful of fortified towns, and eastern land. Meanwhile, Julian still threatened in the west. Suspended between two hostile powers, Constantius didn't dare turn his back on one to attack the other. A fever solved his dilemma. On October 5th, 361, Constantius died from a virus, his body so hot that his attendants could not even touch him. Julian was sole emperor by default of the entire Roman Empire. Chapter 5. The Apostate. Between 361 and 364, Julian tries and fails to restore the old Roman ways. As soon as Julian took control of Constantinople, it became clear that his Christian education had been entirely unsuccessful. He had been in correspondence for some years with the famous rhetoric teacher, Libanius, who guided him in his study of Greek literature and philosophy, and had been in secret sympathy with the old religion of Rome for most of his adult life. Now he openly announced himself as an opponent of Christianity. His baptism, he said, was a nightmare that he wished to forget. He ordered the old temples, many of which had been closed under the reign of the Christian emperors, to be reopened, and he decreed that no Christian could teach literature. Since a literary education was required for all government officials, this would eventually have guaranteed that all Roman officials had received a thoroughly Roman education. It also meant that the Christians in the empire would become chronically undereducated. Most Christians refused to send their children to schools where they would be indoctrinated in the ways of the old Roman religion. Instead, Christian writers began to try to create their own literature, to be used in their own schools. As A.A. Vasiliev writes, they translated the Psalms into forms similar to the Odes of Pindar. The Pentateuch of Moses they rendered into hexameter. The Gospels were rewritten in the style of Plato's dialogues. Most of this literature was so substandard that it disappeared almost at once. Very little has survived. This was an odd kind of persecution, and one that reveals Julian's essential likeness to his Gupta counterparts, kings he would never meet. Julian was essentially a conservative. He wanted to bring back the glorious past. He wanted to draw a line clearly between Roman and non-Roman. It was a disappearing line, thanks to Constantine's decision to unite his empire by faith rather than by their pride in Romanness, and Julian wanted it back. He wanted to rebuild the wall of Roman civilization against not only the Christians, but all who did not share this same tradition. "You know well," Libanius had written to him back in 358, "that if anyone extinguishes our literature, we are put on a level with the barbarians. To have no literature was to have no past. To have no past was to be a barbarian." As far as Julian was concerned, Christians were both barbarians and atheists. They had no literature, and they did not believe in the Roman gods. Julian did realize that the old Roman religion would need updating if it were to compete with the unifying power of the Christian church. So he pursued two strategies. First, he stole the most useful elements of the Christian church for the Roman religion. He studied the hierarchy of the Christian church, which had proved relatively good at holding far-flung congregations together, and reorganized the Roman priesthood in the same way. And he ordered Roman priests to model the worship of the Roman gods on the popular Christian services, importing discourses, like sermons, and singing into the old Roman rituals. Worship of Jupiter had never looked more like worship of Jesus. His second strategy was more subtle. He allowed all of the Christian churchmen who had been banished at various times for being on the wrong side of the Nicene-Arian debate to return. He knew they were incapable of getting along, and sure enough, serious theological arguments were soon breaking out. It was the flip side of Constantine's methods. Julian was capitalizing on Christianity's power to divide, not its power to unify. For all of this, he earned himself the nickname Julian the Apostate. Ironically, his political problems forced him to recognize the rights of barbarians to Roman privileges at the same time that he was restoring the old ideas of Romanness. Unable to fight simultaneously with Shapur on his east and with invading Germanic tribes to the north, he had no choice but to allow the Germanic tribes of the Franks to settle in northern Gaul as federati, Roman allies with many of the rights of Roman citizens. With the threat of the Franks averted, Julian launched a Persian campaign. In 363, he marched east with 85,000 men, not only Romans but also Goths, Germanic tribes who had been federati since the days of Constantine, and Arabs, who were anxious to get their revenge on Shapur for his shoulder tearing. He also brought traditional soothsayers and Greek philosophers with him, in place of the priests and tabernacle Constantine had planned to use. The two groups complicated the enterprise by falling out with each other. The soothsayers insisted that the omens were bad and the army should withdraw, while the philosophers countered that such superstitions were illogical. At the Persian border, he divided his forces and sent 30,000 of his men down the Tigris, himself leading the rest down the Euphrates by means of ships, constructed on the banks of the river where it ran through Roman territory, and launched downstream. The idea was that they would meet at Ctesiphon, the Persian capital, on the east bank of the Tigris, a bit south of Baghdad, and perform a pincer move on the Persians. According to Ammianus, the Roman fleet was an amazing sight, 50 war galleys and 1,000 supply ships with food and bridge-building materials. Shapur, alarmed by the size of the approaching army, left his capital city as a precaution, so when Julian arrived he found the king gone. The armies built bridges across the Tigris to the east bank and laid siege to Ctesiphon anyway. The siege dragged on and on. Shapur, safely away from the action, rounded up additional men and allies from the far corners of his empire and returned to fight the besieging army. Julian was forced to retreat back up the Tigris, fighting the whole way and struggling to keep his men alive. The Persians had burnt all of the fields and storehouses in their path. The retreat took all spring. By early summer, the Roman soldiers hadn't yet made it back to their own border. They were starving, wounded, and constantly harassed by the Persians who pursued them. One June day, during yet another Persian ambush, Julian was struck by a Persian spear that lodged in his lower abdomen. He was carried back to camp, where he slowly bled to death. One of only three Roman emperors to fall in battle against a foreign enemy. Author's note, the other two were Valerian, Persia, 260, and Decius, Goths, 251. Ammianus Marcellinus, who was with the army, describes a beautifully classical death. Julian, resigned to his fate, carrying on a calm discussion about the nobility of the soul with two philosophers until he died. The Christian historian Theodoret insists that Julian died in agony, recognizing too late the power of Christ and exclaiming, "Thou hast won, O Galilean." Of these two equally unlikely accounts, the Christian version comes closest to describing the situation. Julian's army was stranded, besieged, and in need of leadership and rescue. After a bit of arguing and milling around, the officers dressed one of their generals, a dignified and kindly man named Jovian, in the imperial robes, and proclaimed him emperor. Jovian, aged 33, was a Christian. From this point on, Christian emperors would rule the empire. The old Roman religion would never again dominate the Roman court. Not that this brought an end to the striving. It simply meant that the battle between past and the present, the old Rome and the new empire, went underground. Jovian was a pragmatist. Instead of fighting, he put on his crown and asked Shapur for a parley. The treaty, once concluded, allowed the Roman army to go home in peace. In exchange, Jovian agreed to hand over to the Persians all Roman land east of the Tigris, including the Roman fortress of Nisibis. Nisibis would become the center of Persian assaults against the Roman frontier. It never returned to Western control. The army limped westward under Jovian's command to face scorn and fury from the Romans back home. The treaty was condemned as shameful, a disgrace to Rome, an unacceptable conclusion to Julian's bold and disastrous campaign. Jovian himself never even returned to Constantinople. Once he was back in Roman land, he paused at the city of Antioch and started to work at once to chart a middle way. He revoked all of Julian's anti-Christian decrees, but rather than replacing them with equally restrictive decrees against the Roman religion, he declared religious toleration. He was, himself, unabashedly faithful to the Nicene Creed, but he had decided to remove religion from the center of the empire's politics. Christian, Greek, Roman, all would have equal rights to worship and to take part in government. But it was too late. Religious and political legitimacy, religious and political claims to rule, were intertwined at the empire's center. A very strong and charismatic emperor, which the nice-minded Jovian was not, might have managed to hold on to power and proclaim religious tolerance at the same time. But Jovian's political authority was already weak, thanks to the unpopular treaty with Persia. His only hope for hanging on to power was to use religious authority in its place, establishing a strict religious orthodoxy at the center of his power. His refusal to do so meant that he had no authority at all. In 364, 8 months after his elevation to the imperial crown, he died in his tent while he was still making his slow way back towards the eastern capital. Reports of the cause were suspiciously varied. He was said to have died of fumes, from a badly vented stove, from indigestion, from a swollen head. "So far as I know," Ammianus remarks, "no investigation was made of the death. The Roman throne lay open for the next claimant." Chapter 6. Earthquake and Invasion. Between 364 and 376, Natural disaster and barbarian attacks troubled the Roman Empire. Jovian's death meant that the Roman Empire had three emperors in 4 years. A ferocity of changeable circumstances, Ammianus Marcellinus calls it, a time when Rome's religion and Rome's frontiers had shifted as quickly as Rome's chief official. No one supported the claim of Jovian's infant son. Instead, the army, which had become, without design, representatives for the entire empire, chose another officer to be the next emperor. Valentinian was 43, a lifelong soldier and a zealous Christian, something that makes it slightly difficult to get an accurate portrayal of him from the contemporary sources. The historian Zosimus, a devotee of traditional Roman religion, remarks grudgingly that Valentinian was an excellent soldier but extremely illiterate. The Christian historian Theodoret rhapsodizes that Valentinian was distinguished not only for his courage but also for prudence, temperance, justice, and great stature. What the empire needed at this point was not a learned leader but an experienced general, and Valentinian's decision suggests that his army service hadn't necessarily qualified him to be emperor. He was at Nicaea when the army acclaimed him. Before setting out for Constantinople to be crowned, he decided to declare a co-emperor. This was a soldier's precaution. Life was cheap along the roads in the eastern provinces, and Valentinian had no heir. According to Ammianus, he gathered his fellow officers together and asked what they thought of his younger brother and fellow soldier, Valens. There was a silence at this, until finally the commander of cavalry said, "Your Highness, if you love your kin, you have a brother. But if you love the state, look carefully for a man to invest with the purple." It was advice that Valentinian decided to ignore. He gave his brother the imperial title and put him in charge of the Eastern Empire as far as the province of Thracia, then travelled to Italy, where he set up his court not in Rome, but in Milan. This was a brief reorientation to the west, with the senior emperor taking up residence in Italy and the junior emperor in the east, although Valens settled not at Constantinople but at Antioch, on the Orontes River. And it almost immediately became clear why the commander of cavalry had reservations. The empire had all sorts of military problems. Germanic tribes were invading Gaul and pushing across the Danube. The Roman holdings in Britannia were under attack by the natives. The North African territories were suffering from the hostility of the tribes to the south. And Shapur, claiming that the treaty he had sworn with Jovian was nullified by Jovian's death, was getting ready to attack the east. But Valens, in the east, was apparently more worried about inner purity than outer threat. His older brother Valentinian held to Nicene Christianity, but was tolerant both of Arian Christians and of adherents to the traditional state religion. In fact, one of Valentinian's most aggressive moves was to pass a law restricting evening sacrifices to the gods. But as soon as one of his proconsuls pointed out that many of his subjects held to these ancient customs as a way to define themselves as a part of Roman society, Valentinian immediately ordered everyone to disregard his brand new regulations. But the younger Valens belonged to the Arian branch of Christianity, and he was entirely intolerant of any other form of doctrine. He began a war of extermination against the Nicene Christians in Antioch, exiling their leader, driving out the followers, and drowning some of them in the Orontes. This gave the Persians even more freedom to harass the eastern border, since the inexperienced and preoccupied Valens did little to garrison the fortresses on the east. Valens, Zosimus says, had so little experience with governing men that he could not sustain the weight of business. The soldier Ammianus puts it even more succinctly. "During this period," he writes, "practically the whole Roman world heard the trumpet call of war." And then catastrophe struck. At dawn on July 21, 365, an earthquake rumbled from deep beneath the Mediterranean Sea, spreading along the seabed and rising up to the Roman shores. On the island of Crete, buildings collapsed flat on their sleeping occupants. Cyrenaica was shaken, its cities crumbling. The shock travelled up to Corinth, shivering its way across to Italy and Sicily on the west, Egypt and Syria to the east. As Romans all around the coast began to pick their way through the rubble, putting out fires, digging out possessions, and mourning their dead, the water on the southern coast, right at Alexandria on the Nile Delta, was sucked suddenly away from the shore. The people of Alexandria, diverted, went out to the waterfront to see. The sea, with its rolling waves, was driven back and withdrew from the land, remember Zemianus Marcellinus, so that in the abyss of the deep thus revealed, men saw many kinds of sea creatures stuck fast in the slime, and vast mountains and deep valleys. Many ships were stranded as if on dry land, and many men roamed about without fear in the little that remained of the waters, to gather fish and shells with their hands. The entertainment lasted a little less than an hour, and then, Ammianus writes, the roaring sea, resenting as it were this forced retreat, rose in its turn, and over the boiling shoals it dashed mightily upon islands and broad stretches of the mainland, and levelled innumerable buildings in the cities and wherever else they were found. The great mass of waters, returning when it was least expected, killed many thousands of men by drowning. When the tsunami receded, ships lay in splinters all along the shore. Bodies had been tossed into streets and across the tops of buildings, and floated face down in the shallows. Several years later, Ammianus, travelling to a nearby city, saw a ship that had been thrown 2 full miles inland. It still lay on the sand, its seams coming open with decay. In the wake of the destruction, both Valens and Valentinian struggled to hold their domains together. Valens was challenged by the usurper Procopius, a cousin of the dead Emperor Julian, who managed to convince the Gothic soldiers in the army to support his claim to the eastern crown. Valens sent a frantic message west to his brother Valentinian, asking for help, but Valentinian was far away on the battlefield, fighting the Alamanni, another Germanic tribal federation in Gaul, and he did not have soldiers to spare. With the help of substantial bribing, which turned Procopius's 2 chief generals and part of his army against him, Valens managed to defeat Procopius in battle at the city of Thyatira. Once he had the rebel in his hands, he had Procopius torn apart. He also executed Procopius's 2 chief generals, piously condemning them for their helpful treachery. Traditional Roman chroniclers, like Ammianus, found in Procopius's usurpation an explanation for the horrible wave. They simply moved the wave forward in time, placing it after the revolt, and insisting that the rebellion had caused an upheaval in the natural order of things. Christian historians who write of the tsunami were more likely to blame it on Julian the Apostate. God was punishing the empire for Julian's misdeeds. Libanius, Julian's old friend, suggested that Earth was mourning Julian's death. The quake and wave were the honor paid him by Earth, or if you would have it so, by Poseidon. Christian or Roman, they all set out to make sense of the devastation. There had to be a reason for it. There was no place in either the Roman or the Christian world for an event that was not a direct response to human action. No place in either world for random evil. The natural disaster was followed, in short order, by a series of political catastrophes, barbarian attacks that pushed into Roman territory and chipped away at the edges of Roman power. Valens initiated the first catastrophe by declaring war on the Goths. The Gothic soldiers in the army had supported the usurper Procopius, and he wanted to punish them. Up until this point, the Romans and Goths had worked out a means of coexisting. The Goths provided soldiers for the Roman army, and in return were allowed to settle in Roman land with some of the privileges of Roman citizens. And they had become increasingly Christian over the past decades. Their native bishop, Ulfilas, had invented an alphabet and had used it to translate the Bible into their own language, and Ulfilas, like Valens himself, was a zealously Arian Christian. Nicene Christianity, he preached, was an odious and execrable, depraved and perverse invention of the devil. None of this kept Valens from launching his punitive campaign against the Gothic settled lands. His war of revenge began in 367 and dragged on for 3 full years without any particular resolution. It was a bad time to start a war against a people who were inclined to be friendly. In the west, Valentinian was already fighting the Alamanni. Late in 367, as Valens fought against the Goths, the Alamanni surged across the Rhine and attacked Valentinian on his own ground. Valentinian managed to defeat them in a pitched battle, but lost so many men that he was unable to push the invaders back out. Meanwhile, the Roman holdings in Britain were also under barbarian attack. In this case, the barbarians were the tribes who lived to the north. Back in AD 122, the Roman Emperor Hadrian had drawn a line between civilization and wilderness by building a wall across the island.
Roman Britain, the province of Britannia, was south of the wall. 6 towns in Britannia had been given the status of full Roman citizenship, Author's note, the six towns were Eboracum, modern York, Verulamium, St. Albans, Glavum, Gloucester, Lindum, Lincoln, Camalodunum, Colchester, and Londinium, London. The largest, Londinium, had 25,000 inhabitants and a complex Roman infrastructure, shipping lines, baths and drainage, military installations. To the north, as far as the Romans were concerned, lay only wilderness. The tribes who lived north of Hadrian's Wall, as well as on the smaller island west of Britannia, had arrived on British shores as invaders, perhaps in 500 BC. Now they were the natives. 1,000 years of habitation has a funny way of rooting a people into their land, masters of scores of tribal kingdoms. The strongest tribes were the Picts and Caledones, red-haired and large-limbed, wrote the Roman historian Tacitus. On the western island, which had never been invaded by Romans, the Vanii dominated the south from their capital city of Tara, while the Uluti controlled much of the north. Britannia had been troubled for more than a century by land invasions from northern Picts, as well as piratical raids launched by tribes on the western island. Author's note, these pirates were known to the Romans as Scoti, from the word in their own language that means plunderers. This confuses the issue, as the Scoti were not from the modern land of Scotland, but rather from the island now known as Ireland. So technically the Scots at this point were Irish. In the 4th century, these were joined by sea attacks from another Germanic tribe, the Saxons, who came from the lands north of Gaul and sailed across the ocean to plunder the eastern coast of Britannia. The Roman official who was in charge of defending Britannia from these attacks was the Dux Britanniarum. He was aided by a special commander called the Comes Littorae, protector of the shore, whose job was to keep the Saxons away from the southeastern coast. But in late 367, while Valentinian was frantically beating back the Alemanni and Valens was deadlocked with the Goths, the British defences in Britannia fell apart, and barbarians poured into the country from all four sides. It was a carefully planned and coordinated attack. Ammianus Marcellinus calls it the Barbarica Conspirato, the Barbarian Conspiracy. Roman garrison stationed at Hadrian's Wall, who had been fraternizing with the Picts for years, allowed Pictish soldiers to cross over into Roman Britain. At the same time, pirates from the western island landed on the coast, and Saxons invaded both southeast Britannia and northern Gaul. Both the Dux Britanniarum and the Comes Littorae were overwhelmed. In the past decades, Roman forces in Britannia had been slowly depleted by transfers to the army over on the mainland. Although he had his hands full of Alemanni, in 368 Valentinian sent the experienced general Theodosius the Elder over to Britain to try to retake the Roman provinces. Theodosius the Elder went, obediently, taking with him as vice-commander his son Flavius Theodosius. He established himself at Londinium, from where he waged a year-long war that finally restored Roman control of Britannia. "He warmed the north with Pictish blood," one Roman poet wrote admiringly, "and icy Ireland wept for the heaps of dead." New forts were built along the southeastern coast, with towers where guards could keep an eye out for the approach of Saxon ships. But all was not well. The invasions had ravaged cities and burned settlements, wiped out entire garrisons, and destroyed the trade that had once existed between Britannia and the northern tribes. The Pictish villages near the wall had now been burned, their people slaughtered, and along the border the Roman garrisons had shut themselves into crude and isolated fortresses. Back in the Roman Empire proper, the royal brothers were forced to make peace with their barbarian enemies. Valens gave up on conquering the Goths in 369 and swore out a treaty with their leaders. In 374, Valentinian made peace with the Alemanni king, Macrianus, but almost immediately yet another barbarian war broke out. The year before, Valentinian had ordered new forts built north of the Danube, in land that belonged to the Germanic tribe known as the Quadi. The Quadi were not much of a threat, a nation not greatly to be feared, Ammianus calls them, and when the fort building began, they sent a polite embassy to the local commander, asking that it stop. The complaints were ignored. The embassies were sent again. Finally, the Roman commander, apparently unable to think of a better solution, invited the Quadi king to a banquet and murdered him. This atrocious mishandling of the affair so infuriated the Quadi that they joined together with their neighbours and stormed across the Danube.
None of the Roman farmers who lived on the frontier were expecting the attack. The invaders crossed the Danube while no hostility was anticipated and fell upon the country people, who were busy with their harvest. Most of them they killed, the survivors they led home as prisoners. Valentinian, furious with the incompetence of the commander who had started the fight, recalled Theodosius the Elder and his son Flavius from Britannia and sent them to the trouble spot. He arrived shortly after, breathing fire and promising to punish wayward officials, but when he saw the devastation of his frontier with his own eyes, he was horrified. He decided to ignore the murder of the Quadi king and launch a punitive invasion instead. He himself led the attack. Ammianus says, disapprovingly, that he burned villages and put to death without distinction of age or Quadi civilians he could get his hands on. In fact, his behavior suggests that he had lost touch with reality in some frightening way. He cut off a groom's hand after the horse the groom was holding for him reared up as he tried to mount. He had an inoffensive junior secretary tortured to death because of an ill-timed joke. He even ordered Theodosius the Elder, who had served him so well in Britannia, put to death after Theodosius lost a battle, and exiled his son Flavius to Hispania. Finally, the Quadi sent ambassadors to negotiate for a peace. When they tried to explain that they had not been the original aggressors, Valentinian grew so enraged that he had a stroke. As if struck by a bolt from the sky, Ammianus says, he was seen to be speechless and suffocating, and his face was tinged with a fiery flush. On a sudden, his blood was checked, and the sweat of death broke out upon him. He died without naming an heir. The Western Empire was temporarily without leadership, and the officers on the frontier hastily suspended all hostilities with the Quadi. Valen sent word that Valentinian's son, the 16-year-old Gratian, should inherit the crown and reign as co-emperor with his little brother, 4-year-old Valentinian II. Gratian's first act, one that showed amazingly good judgment, was to recall Flavius Theodosius, son of the dead Theodosius the Elder, from Hispania, and to put him in charge of the defense of the northern frontier. Flavius Theodosius had learned to fight in Britannia, and he proved to be a brilliant strategist. By 376, a year after Valentinian's death, he was the highest-ranking general in the entire central province. His skill was needed. He had begun to hear rumors of a new threat, the merciless advance of nomadic enemies from the east, fearless fighters who slaughtered and destroyed, who had no religion, no knowledge of right and wrong, not even a proper language. All the tribes east of the Black Sea were in agitation. The Alans, a people who had lived for centuries east of the Don River, had already been driven from their land. The king of the Goths, himself a terror to his neighbors, had been defeated. Refugees were crowding to the northern side of the Danube, asking to enter the security of Roman territory. The Huns had arrived at the distant edges of the Western world. To the Romans, who had never seen them, they were as frightening as earthquake and tsunami, an evil force that could barely be resisted. Historians of the time had no idea exactly where these frightening newcomers came from, but they were sure it was somewhere awful. The Roman historian Procopius insists that they were descended from witches who had sexual congress with demons, producing Huns, a stunted, foul and puny tribe, scarcely human and having no language save one which bore but slight resemblance of human speech. The story isn't original. Procopius borrowed it from the book of Genesis, which says that in the times of wickedness before the great flood, the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. The church fathers believed that this described the union of fallen angels, demons, who slept with human women and fathered children who brought great evil to the world. The Christian interpretation of history had been married to the threatening present. The Huns were not just barbarians, but demons out to destroy the Christians of the Roman Empire, the kingdom of God on earth. The Huns were still distant, though, and the immediate problem was what to do with the refugees. Valens received an official delegation of Goths, asking permission to settle in the Roman land on the other side of the Danube. He had already been forced to make peace with the Goths, and now he decided to permit this immigration. In return, the newcomers could farm the uncultivated land in Thracia and provide additional soldiers for the Roman army, as other Gothic peoples who had settled in the empire had agreed to do. With the dam of the Roman border breached, new waves of fleeing Goths poured across the Danube. The Roman officials who were in charge of the new settlers were quickly overwhelmed by the paperwork. Taxes were mishandled, money was misappropriated, the newcomers wiped out food supplies and began to go hungry. Within 2 years, Valens' decision led yet again to war with the barbarians. An army of angry Goths stormed through Thracia, spreading a most foul confusion of robbery, murder, bloodshed, and fires, killing, burning villages, taking captives, and heading for the walls of Constantinople. Valens set out from Antioch to go to the defense of his city. In the west, young Gratian started east to help his uncle. Before he could arrive with his reinforcements, the paths of Valens and the Goths intersected at the city of Hadrianople, west of Constantinople, a city named after Hadrian, the emperor who had built a wall against the barbarians. On August 9th, 378, Valens plunged into the battle among his men and was killed. Two-thirds of his army fell with him. The Roman soldiers were thirsty and starving after their forced march. Valens was not wearing the imperial purple, and his body was so badly disfigured that it was never identified. The ground, says Ammianus, was ankle-deep in blood. All during the next night, the people of Hadrianople could hear, coming from the dark, the wails of the wounded and the death rattles of the dying left on the battlefield. The Goths laid siege to the city, but they had less experience with sieges than with hand-to-hand combat and soon withdrew. They tried the same at Constantinople, and again found that they had no hope of breaking down the walls, so they withdrew. But the point had been made. The Roman Empire was far from all-conquering. Earthquake and flood could wreck it, a distant band of barbarians could disrupt it, and a ragged band of exiles could bring down the emperor.
Chapter 7. Refounding the Kingdom. Between 371 and 412, Goguryeo adopts Buddhist principles and Confucian teachings and defeats its neighbors. All the way to the east beyond Constantinople, beyond Persia and India, past the empires of the Jin and the Beiwei, another king struggled to recover from defeat. In 371, the young king Sosurim inherited the crown of the kingdom of Goguryeo, and with it a shattered and demoralized country. He had no firm foundation on which to rebuild. His army had been devastated, his officers killed in battle, his land laid waste. His answer arrived in 372 in the hands of a monk. The kingdom of Goguryeo lay on the peninsula east of the Yellow Sea. The ancestors of its people had probably come from the Yellow River Valley long before, but the cultures of China and of the peninsula had been separate for centuries. Author's note: linguistically, the peoples of the peninsula were separate from the Chinese quite early. Their language belonged to the Tungusic group of languages, which is different from the Sinitic group of languages to which Old Chinese, or Archaic Chinese, the oldest form of written Chinese from the center of the continent, belongs. The people of the peninsula claimed an ancient and distinguished heritage. According to their own myths, the first kingdom in their land was Joseon, created by the god Tangun in 2333 BE, the era of the oldest Chinese kingdoms. Before its collapse, the Chinese dynasty of the Han had captured the land across the north of the peninsula and had settled Chinese officials and their families there. In the south, three independent kingdoms formed: Silla, Goguryeo, and Baekje. Meanwhile, on the very southern tip of the peninsula, a fourth set of tribes, the Gaya Confederacy, resisted attempts by its neighbors to fold it into the increasingly strong monarchies. The kingdom of Goguryeo had always been the most aggressive and the most troublesome to the Han, who had hoped to keep the kingdom south of their colonies from developing too much power. By temperament, the Romance of the Three Kingdoms remarked, the people of Goguryeo are violent and take delight in brigandage. By the time the Han Empire fell, its control over its lands in Old Joseon had shrunk to a single administrative district, Lilang, centered around the old city of Wanggomsong, modern Pyongyang. Lilang outlasted its Han parent, surviving until 313. In that year, the ruler of the kingdom of Goguryeo, the ambitious and energetic King Michion, pushed his way north and captured Lilang, adding it to his own territory and ousting the remaining Chinese forces. This made Goguryeo, under King Michion, three times the size of any of its neighbors. It was the most powerful, the most dominant of the three kingdoms of Korea, which made it the biggest target as well. King Michion died in 331, leaving his son Goguryeo on the throne.
King Gogugwan was apparently not a warrior equal to his father. He followed a 30-year policy of inaction, during which Goguryeo was sacked twice. In 342, armies from the 16 kingdoms took thousands of prisoners and broke down the walls of its capital city, Gukkanesong, in 371. The crown prince of Baekje led an invading army all the way up to Wanggeomsong. Shaken out of his withdrawal, King Gogugwan of Goguryeo came out in person to fight his neighbor. He was killed defending the Wanggeomsong fortress. Baekje claimed much of Goguryeo's territory as his own, and Sosurim, son of the defeated king, grandson of the great Michion, was left with the shrunken shambles of Goguryeo. Not long after he came to the throne, a Buddhist monk travelling from the west arrived at his court. This monk, Sun Do, brought with him gifts and Buddhist scriptures, along with the assurance that the understanding of Buddhism would help to protect Goguryeo from its enemies. King Sosurim welcomed Sun Do and listened to him, and in 372 he embraced the faith as his own. The following year, he established the Taehak, the National Confucian Academy, patterned on Chinese principles. Buddhism and Confucianism, essentially very different, formed a useful intersection for Goguryeo. Sun Do taught Sosurim and his court that discontent, unhappiness, ambition, and fear were samskrita, conditions of the mind that were non-existent. The enlightened student recognized that in fact there was no discontent, no unhappiness, no ambition, no fear. The kingdom of Goguryeo was itself samskrita, a conception that had no ultimate reality. Should King Sosurim and his officials truly understand this, they would be able to function in the world while recognizing, in the words of the Zen master Sheng Yan, that the world and phenomenon have no true existence. Their decisions would not be shaped and tainted by the desire for gain, the desire for security, the desire for happiness. Confucianism, on the other hand, accepted the reality of the physical world and taught its adherents how to live properly, with virtue and responsibility within it. The principles of Buddhism gave Goguryeo a new unity, a spiritual oneness. The principles of Confucianism gave King Sosurim a tested framework for training new army officers, secretaries, accountants, and bureaucrats, everything a state needed to prosper. Buddhism was the philosophy of the monk, Confucianism the doctrine of the training academy. And since Buddhism was not a creedal religion, one with a written statement of faith to which its believers assented, the two different ways of thinking existed harmoniously side by side. Buddhism, unlike Christianity, was never viewed by its practitioners as exclusive, a system that demanded the relinquishment of all opposing beliefs. So although King Sosurim made Buddhism his own, he did not make it an official state religion. This would have given it an exclusive authority, which made no sense within the Buddhist framework. Goguryeo was no longer tottering on the edge of dissolution. King Sosurim was hauling it back from the brink, refounding it as a state. But it would be some time before the foundation he was building would be solid enough to support a campaign of conquest and expansion. Meanwhile, Baekje remained the most powerful state on the peninsula, under the rule of Gyeongchogo, the king who had launched the invasion that killed Sosurim's father. Baekje's borders had swollen to encompass much of the south, and King Gyeongchogo, like his northern neighbor, needed to put into place practices that would keep the territory united under a single king. Never before had the crown of Baekje passed from father to son. One warrior after another had claimed it through strength. But a battle over the succession would, in all likelihood, result in Baekje losing territory, thanks to its leaders putting their energy into inside politics rather than outside expansion. King Gyeongchogo, protecting his conquests, declared that his crown should pass to his son. When he died in 375, his arrangements held firm. The throne passed first to his son and then, after his son's early death, to his grandson, Chimnyu. In 384, the Indian monk Malananda, on a pilgrimage through China, came from the Jin to Baekje. When King Chimnyu heard of his approach, he came out to meet Malananda and took him into the capital city to listen to what he had to say, and, like King Sosurim, he too accepted the teachings of Buddhism. For both kings, Buddhism held the sheen of antiquity, a flavor of ancient Chinese tradition. Both kings ruled over relatively new kingdoms, and in those kingdoms all things Chinese were more desirable. Buddhism carried with it the resonance of centuries of inherited authority, a faint echo, by way of the jinn, of the distant and glorious past. By the time Sosorim's nephew, Guang Gaito, came to the throne in 391, the foundation laid by his predecessors was strong enough to support conquest, and the spread of Buddhist philosophy did nothing to convince Guang Gaito that he should forgo ambition and earthly gain. Barely a year after his coronation, Guang Gaito organized an attack against Baekje, which just decades before had seemed impregnable. He had managed to make an alliance with the third kingdom on the peninsula, Silla. In 391, Silla was ruled by King Naimul, a man of forethought. He had already sent diplomats to the Jin court across the sea. Now he responded to Guang Gaito's overtures with friendship, happy to have an ally against the constantly encroaching Baekje. The armies of Silla and Goguryeo joined together and stormed through Baekje. The kingdom was unable to resist for long. Baekje was overwhelmed by the combined armies of its neighbors. In 396, the king of Baekje handed over 1,000 hostages to guarantee his good behavior and agreed to pay homage to King Guang Gaito. The rest of Guang Gaito's rule was spent in conquest so extensive that Guang Gaito earned himself the nickname the Great Expander. Between 391 and 412, the Expander conquered 65 walled cities and 1,400 villages for Goguryeo, recovered the northern land that had been taken away decades before, and made the Baekje retreat to the south. His deeds are carved on the stone stele that still stands at his tomb, the Guang Gaito stele, the first historical document of Korean history. With his majestic military virtue, he encompassed the four seas like a spreading willow tree, it tells us. His people flourished in a wealthy state, and the five grains ripened abundantly. His own words are preserved in the temple he built to commemorate his victories. Believing in Buddhism, the dedicatory inscription reads, "We seek prosperity." Chapter 8. The Catholic Church. Between 378 and 382, Gratian rejects the old Roman religion, while Theodosius tries to legislate brotherhood and unity. 5 months after the death of Valens, the Emperor Gratian appointed a new ruler for the East, Flavius Theodosius, who now became Emperor Theodosius I. Gratian's younger brother Valentinian II, technically his co-emperor, was still only 7 years old, and he needed a competent colleague. The greatest threat to the East, Persian invasion, was diminishing. In 379, Shapur the Great of Persia died after a spectacularly long reign of nearly 70 years, and was succeeded by his elderly brother, Ardashir II, who was more concerned with hanging on to his crown than with invading foreign parts. Instead, both Gratian and Theodosius turned to ensure that the Roman Empire would survive. The Goths to the north were growing steadily more powerful, but the more immediate problem was the ongoing tendency of the Roman coalition to pull apart from the inside. Constantine's hope for an empire held together by faith was still unrealized. Gratian, a devout Christian, soon found himself at odds with the Roman senators who still held to the traditional Roman state religion. 4 years after the Battle of Hadrianople, Gratian made it quite clear to the Senate that he would not allow the Roman gods to undermine the empire's Christian faith. In 382, he removed the altar of victory from the Senate building in Rome. It had stood there since Augustus's defeat of Antony and Cleopatra 400 years before, as tribute to the goddess of victory. The senators protested, but Gratian stood firm. He also removed the title Pontifex Maximus, high priest of the Roman state religion, from his list of titles. And when the sacred robes were brought to him, as was traditional, for him to put on, he refused to don them. In doing so, he was rejecting not just the Roman gods, but the entire Roman past. As Zosimus points out with asperity, the kings of Rome had accepted the title Pontifex Maximus since the days of Numa Pompilius, 1,000 years before. Even Constantine had put on the robes. "If the emperor refuses to become pontifex," one of the priests is said to have muttered at the time, "we shall soon make one." Whether Gratian's power could survive the hostility of the senators remained to be seen. To the east, Theodosius was forced to deal with the destructive power of Christian division. Arguments about the Arian take on the divinity of Christ, as opposed to the Nicene understanding, had spread to the lowest levels of society. Everywhere throughout the city is full of such things, complained the Bishop Gregory of Nyssa in a sermon preached at Constantinople. The alleys, the squares, the thoroughfares, the residential quarters, among cloak salesmen, those in charge of the money-changing tables, those who sell us our food. For if you ask about change, they philosophize to you about the begotten and the unbegotten, and if you ask about the price of bread, the reply is, the Father is greater, and the Son is subject to him. If you say, is the bath ready? They declare the Son has his being from the non-existent. I am not sure what this evil should be called, inflammation of the brain, or madness, or some sort of epidemic disease, which contrives the derangement of reasoning. To restore the empire to the vision of Christian unity that Constantine had seen so clearly, Theodosius turned to law. He used the legal structures of the ancient Roman state to support the Christian religion. Never mind that it was diametrically opposed to the ancient Roman traditions. He used the power of the emperor to shape the Christian faith so that the Christian faith could shape the empire. The interweaving of the two traditions continued to change both of them in ways that would prove impossible to undo. 2 years after taking the throne, in the year 380, Theodosius declared that Nicene Christianity was the one true faith, and threatened dissenters with legal penalties. In doing so, he called into being a single, unified Catholic, the word means universal, applying to all humankind, Christian Church. He enacted, writes the Christian historian Sozomen, that the title of Catholic Church should be exclusively confined to those who rendered equal homage to the three persons of the Trinity, and that those individuals who entertained opposite opinions should be treated as heretics, regarded with contempt, and delivered over to punishment. Long before Theodosius, Christian bishops had distinguished the Ecclesia Catholica from the Hieretici, the heretics, those who were by belief outside of the stream of true Christian doctrine. But never before had heretic been defined by law. Now, heretic had a legal definition, someone who did not hold to the Nicene Creed. All of the people shall believe in God within the concept of the Holy Trinity.